Goodness. The eighth talk in a series on the fruit of the Spirit was presented by Ron Julian on August 13, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Since what we're trying to do here is get some feel for what Paul means by the words that he uses, although we're interested in Galatians 5, we're actually not going to be looking there very much. We're going to be going other places to try to get a feel for what it is that he's talking about. Today we want to talk about the next in the list. I always have this moment of panic that I have miscounted and I've missed one of them or in the wrong one, but as I reckon it, we're talking about goodness today. And so that's what we're going to take a shot at. Let me just remind you again briefly what it is that's happening in this context. The argument that Paul is exploring in this part of Galatians, having gone to a great deal of great lengths in the letter to talk about the problem of legalism and the justification that is ours not by keeping the law but by being people of faith, people who believe the gospel. In the last part of the letter, I think Paul is dealing with another aspect of the problem that the Judaizers represent, that idea that somehow if you keep the law, that's the way that you're going to promote righteousness. And if you tell people that they don't need to keep the law, that somehow you're going to promote anarchy and immorality. And what Paul's arguing is, no, it is those who are forgiven through what Christ did on the cross, who have the Spirit of God at work in them, and are living out the implications of their faith by the power of the Spirit of God. Those are the ones that actually arrive at human life the way God wants it to be lived in this age. It is not by being a legalist that you promote goodness. It is by being a person in whom the Spirit is at work. So his list of the fruit of the Spirit really in a way is meant to contrast what he calls the works of the flesh, that which comes from the human being by nature, our selfishness, our dismissal of God, and so on. And in particular, for the legalists that he's talking to, the kind of self-righteousness, condemning judgmentalism, and so on, that is not really righteousness, but is an expression of our flesh. So that's the context. And the list that he has been proposing here, he's saying, this is what it really looks like. So both this is what we can look to the Spirit to be accomplishing in us, but also at the same time, this is what we ought to be pursuing. If our lives are given over to pursuing something that looks different than this list, then there's something is out of whack here. We don't really understand what it is we have been called to. So the one we want to talk about today is goodness, and I want to talk about basically one passage today in Paul. It's in the book of Ephesians. So as I said, we're looking in Galatians, but I want to go to Ephesians to get something of a feel for what it is that Paul has in mind when he talks about goodness. I think, as before we go into it, let me just say that what we should have in mind as we approach this, and we're trying to understand what is it that Paul is thinking, what kind of a quality is he talking about. If you think about that contrast between good and evil, that's what he's emphasizing here when he talks about goodness. It's not just that vague sort of being nice to people or something like that, but we're talking about the pursuit of that which is right, which is holy and good, as opposed to that which is evil and against God. That's the concept that we're dealing with here. So the passage I want to look at to kind of explore this a little bit is in Ephesians chapter 5, starting in verse 3. This is that part of the letter where Paul is working out exhorting them to live in keeping with that which they say they believe. He's exploring the implications of the gospel for the way they live. And he says in verse 3, "Do not let immorality or any impurity or greed even be named among you, as is proper among saints." Okay, let's not be thrown by the word saint here. We're not talking about, you know, Saint Augustine and all of the people who have been named as saints along the way. We're talking about holy ones, ones who belong to God. The ones who are holy are those who belong to God, who are distinctive in this world, and who have a certain mark on their life as being distinctively belonging to God. So we are saints. Every believer is a saint, is a holy one, in the sense that we're part of God's stuff. He has accepted us and brought us in. We are not part of the mundane and the profane, that which is going to ultimately be thrown away, but we are that which is God's. And so we are holy because he has accepted us. In the process, though, we are not just holy because God says, "You belong to me, I accept you, you are distinctively mine," but because we belong to him, there is something about us that sets us apart. It is our faith, ultimately, and the implications of that faith. There is something different about a believer in this world than those who do not believe. And it is that which marks us as holy ones. So when he says here, it is proper for saints, for holy ones, to conduct themselves in a certain way, that's what he's getting at. Are we, in fact, conducting ourselves? Are we talking, in this case, in a way that is fitting with what is distinctive about us? In other words, is it fitting with what we believe? We have been called out to believe a certain thing and to live a certain way. And is the way that we're conducting ourselves in keeping with that? That's the issue that he's exploring here. And he mentions three things. First of all, immorality. I think the word that he uses here pretty specifically focuses on sexual immorality. That's what we're talking about here. And let me stop and talk about that for a second. Now, you need to bear with me here. We're going to be exploring this passage. Remember, our purpose in exploring this passage is to come to some understanding of what Paul has in mind when he talks about goodness. So keep that in the back of your mind. That's where we're heading here. But I need to explain some things. Okay, so one of the things he says not to let be named among you is immorality, sexual immorality. We as Christians have gotten the reputation, and it has been deserved in some cases, in many cases throughout history, but we have gotten the reputation of basically being against sexuality, that we think that sexuality is a bad thing. I don't know if you remember, if any of you either read the book or saw the movie of the Name of the Rose. And one of the things that's striking in that is that all of the monks in that situation have this attitude towards sexuality, that it is this awful, horrible thing, that you couldn't possibly be a godly person and have anything to do with it. Well, that's not the Bible's perspective. Sexuality is something that was created by God. Marriage is an institution that God created. He means men and women to come together in marriage, and sexuality is very much a part of that. It's seen as a gift. It is something good. So when Paul speaks against sexual immorality here, he is not speaking against sexuality as such. The problem, and I mean, it's not hard to understand once you realize the kinds of people we are and what we're being called to here. Sexuality is a powerful force in life. It is a powerful pleasure. The desires that drive us there are strong, and the pleasures that come from it are strong, which means that we, as self-centered human beings, are powerfully motivated to pursue it, even when we shouldn't. If we acknowledge God and the reality of God's claim on our lives, then we're acknowledging his right to establish the limits in which sexuality ought to operate, and that's what we don't want to do. So the fact is, there are limits. God created sexuality to be a certain thing. And it seems to me that we could talk about a number of aspects of it, but two very important aspects of it. First of all, it is meant to be a God-given language by which a husband and wife express their lifelong commitment to each other. And I think Jack has been very helpful in helping to spell out the biblical and philosophical implications of that. It's been very helpful to me. But part of the intention of it, there is a part of sexuality that expresses something between two people. There is an implicit promise being made, a uniqueness. You belong to me, I belong to you. And also, sexuality is a God-given means by which children come into the world. You have to be pretty dense not to notice that children and sexuality tend to go together. And that's the way God meant it to be. Obviously, it has been designed to be that way. So, naturally, given the world's inclination to pursue things that are powerfully pleasurable and not being willing to submit to the limits of what is there by nature, we decide that we want to remove the limits. So, we want the pleasure of sexuality without acknowledging the commitment that is inherent in it. We want to deny that there is any sort of expression of lifelong faithfulness that is involved in sexuality. We want to maintain that it is just, in essence, an animal act that we are free to do whenever we want because it's just the way we are. And we want to separate sexuality from procreation because children can be inconvenient and a lifelong commitment in and of themselves, and we would like to be able to pursue the pleasure without reaping the consequences. So it's pretty easy to understand how we end up wanting sexuality to be the kind of thing where we are not making any commitment to our partner or have any thought for the children that might result from it. The world around us at this point, I mean, it has gone in and out. It has always been the tendency of the world to do this. We seem to be in a particularly ignorant phase of humanity, it seems to me, at this point, where we have essentially denied that goodness has anything to do with sexual purity. Think of how much, I don't know, if you've ever thought about this, if you think about our entertainment, and you think about our political life, I mean, we as a people, how we conduct ourselves and what we think about, you think about how much of it, in one way or another, centers around our perception of sexuality and its place, and in particular, our unwillingness to submit to those limits. I mean, what are the big issues that we wrestle with? Abortion, Planned Parenthood in schools, the acceptance of homosexuality, the easy acceptance of sex outside of marriage. I mean, it's not too strong to say that for a very significant part of our culture now, if you wanted to define what the good person is the one who defends a woman's right to choose, makes contraceptives available to school kids, embraces homosexuality as a valid lifestyle, and basically embraces any expression of sexuality as a valid lifestyle choice. The one evil is to look on any of those things with disfavor. I've told this story before, but it was very striking to me. A couple of years ago, I guess it was, I caught a minute of George Carlin in a interview show. George Carlin, I don't know if you've noticed, is kind of, he has this sort of father figure, wise person sort of reputation in our culture. I mean, he's gone from being a comedian to sort of being a philosopher, kind of a secular saint. George Carlin is one of those people you have to listen to in the culture at large. And he was commenting on the ridiculousness of Christian morality and that sort of thing, and talking about if you look around in the animal world, what is more natural? I mean, you know, animals just do it all the time, right? I mean, that's just the way it is. And it's so perverse of us to have set these limits and to established these, the idea that somehow restraint is appropriate in these areas because it's so obviously against what we are as animals. Well, it's really striking that somebody could say something like that and that our culture would buy it. Because the influence of Christianity on our culture in the past, even among those who were not believers, would have been that one of the things that we accepted and understood is that as people made in the image of God, we are not just animals. That the fact is that there is something distinctive. Our moral sense, that ability to choose, to not just act on instinct, but to actually decide, is this appropriate or not, is one of the things that sets us apart from the animals. And in his easy sort of funny way, George Carlin just swept that aside. I say, well, that doesn't make any sense. We're animals and we ought to do what we want. Okay, so that's the one of the things then that Paul has in his list is immorality, sexual immorality, the unwillingness to acknowledge the limitations that are there in the very nature of things. Ultimately, an unwillingness to acknowledge that God is God, that he created us, and that he created sexuality for a certain purpose. The next thing in his list is uncleanness, impurity. It's the opposite of holiness. Anything which defiles, degrades, stains, that sort of thing. I'm reminded of the language that James uses where he says the true religion is to keep oneself unstained by the world. And by the world, we're talking about human life lived out there as if God were not there. When we talk about worldliness or the world in the Bible, what we're talking about is the way life seems if you put God aside and say he does not exist, he is not my creator, his standards of right and wrong are irrelevant. I make of life what I can make of it here, given what I have in the just the surrounding environment. I deal with what I've got, myself and the resources around me. When I'm living that way, I'm living in the world, as if this creation was all there was. I don't have anything real helpful to say about the word here, impure, unclean. I think it's a broader idea than sexual impurity. I think it's just anything that would defile me, any sort of acceptance of evil, any sort of easy acceptance of the idea that looking out for number one is the most important thing, lying and stealing and cheating, the easy acceptance of a degrading way of talking about other people, indulging in hate. I mean, all of those things that actually defile me and make me what I ought not be. So, like I said, I don't have anything, I couldn't find any real good examples of that at this point, but clearly what he has in mind is we are to stay away from that which degrades us, from that which stains what otherwise, what we would be otherwise if we were living in keeping with what we understand our faith to call us to. So that's a little vague, and I apologize for that. The third one that he mentions is a very easy one to understand. Greed, covetousness, that idea that I need to have more stuff. Right below, in the verse we'll look at in a minute, but I wanted to mention it here, Paul refers to the greedy man as an idolater, which is a very common biblical theme and one that we really need to get a hold of. The idea being that that sense that I have to have more stuff, more power, more status, more of what the world has to offer me, I've got to have that in order for life to be what I want life to be. It really does confront us with that question, whom do you trust? The idolatry that Israel showed in the religious setting that they were in is really no different than the idolatry we show when we think that the stuff of this world is what it takes to make life fulfilling. I mean, it's that same sense. Israel had Yahweh coming to them and saying, I am on your side. I am prepared to go to bat for you. I am going to sustain you. I am going to give you life. Put your trust in me, and I will bring you into blessing. And their choice was, yeah, but you know, the people around us are worshiping Baal, and what if Baal gets mad at us? I mean, okay, I want to keep Yahweh happy, but I'd better keep Baal happy too, because Baal, you know, he's the god of this territory here, and you never know what might happen if you get Baal mad at you. So it's that trying to have it both ways. Idolatry is very much that trying to have it both ways. Yes, I acknowledge that God is there, but I also know the world around me is teaching me that you got to have this in order to make things work. And I'm not willing to say no to that. I'm not willing to say I don't believe it. That's idolatry. I have set up an idol. There is another God other than God. Well, greed and covetousness is idolatry, Paul says. It is a way of setting up something other than God and saying, this is the thing. God is not enough. God's assurances that he is on my side are not enough for me. Because obviously, I could have God on my side, but I might not have enough stuff now. Or I might not have enough power now. Or I might not have enough status now, and that would be uncomfortable, and I can't have that. God's promises are all fine and good, but everybody knows what you need to have, and so I better make sure that I get it. And so, that's why the Bible so much, just as sexuality is one of those places, one of those touchstone issues where we confront the question, what do I think I am, and who do I think God is, and what do I think of him? So, the stuff of this world is another one of those touchstone places. What do I think life consists of? Am I willing to remember that it's all going to burn? Jesus said I could gain the whole world and lose my soul, and then it would have profited me nothing. What would I gain if I could have it all? I'd have all the power, all the stuff of this world. I could have anything in this world that I want. What good would it do me if God were not on my side? And likewise, if God is on my side, then I don't need the wealth of this world on my side. And indeed, that's what he's telling me. He's telling me, ultimately, you got to choose. Where do you think the power really lies? Okay, so here are these qualities that Paul talks about. Immorality, impurity, covetousness. These are the things that should not be named among us, even, he says. Now, I don't think that he means, it doesn't make any sense for Paul to be saying, when he says not to name them among us, I don't think he says that we shouldn't acknowledge that they exist or talk about them or explain what it is they do. Paul violates his own exhortation here all the time, if that's what he means, because he often talks about evil and talks about it in some detail so that we understand what it is, what is its nature, what it is we're being encouraged not to do. He can describe the works of the flesh in some detail. He can describe the nature of the error in the world around us and go into graphic detail sometimes. So it's not that. It's not that he's saying, just pretend that it's not there. Shh, don't talk about that. We don't want to talk about that. That's not what he means. What he's getting at here, though, I think, is the world around us is very much prepared in its actions and in its words, in the way it talks, the things that it talks about and the way it talks about them, to talk as if these things were neutral or good. And what Paul is saying is don't do that. I think his whole exhortation in this section is to not fall into the trap. Okay, I'm going to keep myself pure. You don't find me doing those things that the world is doing out there. But what do you talk about? What is it that your mouth is showing about what you value and what you think is true? That's the issue that Paul is exploring here. What our talk says about what we value, what we believe, what we think is ultimately worth pursuing. And so he goes on. There must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. Here again, that talking theme is being explored. That's what he has on his mind in this section. Don't let your talk be dirty, vulgar, and foolish, basically, is what he's saying. And instead, give thanks. We could really trivialize this kind of passage by turning it simply into an injunction. Don't swear, don't use foul language. Instead, you should go around saying, "Bless the Lord, thank you, Lord." I'm at work and I'm among a group of people, and somebody says, "Damn," and I respond, "Oh Lord, bless us," or something like that. I mean, that's what Paul is calling on me to do here. I don't think so. I don't think that's at the heart of what he's getting at. Gratitude is an issue that is explored a lot in Paul's letters. Gratitude is based on an understanding that God is there, that what he has promised is worthwhile and real and can be counted on. What am I grateful for, ultimately? I'm grateful that I am a creature of God. I'm grateful that he is on my side. I'm grateful that life cannot fail to come to me. If I have put my trust in God, then I have put my trust in the only one that matters, and I am on my way to life. I have the power that created the universe at work on my side, and I am on a journey toward life. That's a lot to be grateful for, if I understand that. Well, I think if you can see how profound an impact that would have on the way I think about things, if I really saw my life in those terms, if I really saw what God was doing for me and had a gratitude for it, how that is a very fitting sort of opposition to the dirty, the profane, the immoral, the greedy, all that I might talk about as if somehow that stuff was kind of cool and somehow it gave you something worthwhile in this world. It gives me nothing worthwhile. I'm not responding to the circumstances of my life, if I have understood God, I'm not responding to the circumstances of my life in the way that the world would. I don't think of those things as valuable. I think of what God has done for me as valuable, and I'm grateful. So Paul is contrasting a thoughtless, foolish, blind sort of going along with the way the world talks and thinks about things with an actual, faithful, godly, sanctified view of life, that I've actually understood where life is to be found, and I have no interest in where the world is going because I have something better and I'm grateful for it. So, once again, the issue is not the surface one of, watch your mouth, but it's remember what you think is true, and thus let your conduct, let what you talk about reflect what it is you are about as a person. "For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." Now, this is strong language, and this kind of language always gets us nervous, I think, because if we are honest with ourselves, we recognize that in our own struggles with sin, I cannot claim that my life is free from immorality, impurity, and greed, just to name the big three he's got there. I mean, the fact is, I struggle with all of those things. So, if we say that the immoral, impure, and covetous person has no inheritance in the kingdom of God, that can sound pretty devastating, because it sounds as if he's saying that I have no inheritance in the kingdom of God. And let's admit, if we just took this by itself, without paying attention to the way Paul talks about things, we might interpret it that way. It might be true that I have no inheritance in the kingdom of God. There would not be a trace of immorality, impurity, or greed in my life. There would be no struggle with those things if I were really a believer. And therefore, I'm not one. That's possible. In fact, I've been told that that's the case by more than one person in my life. So, you need to take that into consideration. The person who's talking to you may not be a believer at all. I don't think that's the case, however, and I don't think that's what Paul is getting at. We can see as he goes along, we'll see in a minute here, that he's not painting a picture of a Christian as one who automatically and necessarily has no trace of sin or struggle with sin. but he characterizes immorality, impurity, and covetousness as being the characteristics of the sons of disobedience. This is the thing upon which the wrath of God is going to come. What do I think of those things? Why would I talk in such a way as if somehow immorality was cool? As if somehow it were kind of hip to be foul, to be profane, to talk about the stuff of this world as if it was the stuff that really mattered. Why would I do that? Don't I know that it is those who have invested themselves in those things that are going to be lost in the end? What did they gain from it? They didn't gain anything. Their words are empty. Anyone who would deceive you into thinking that there's somehow something to this that you've got to get a hold of. You've got to make sure that you get, you know, your stash. And when people talk in that way, you need to get right in there with them. You know, don't distance yourself from the people of the world around you, because, you know, they're hip. I mean, they know what's going on. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. And the fact is that pressure is there. I think all of us have felt that sense. I know. I can see those situations in which, and I'm ashamed of them, but I know those situations where somebody says something that implies a certain value to the things of this world or something that I don't believe in. And yet somehow in the circumstances I manage to find a way to say something that keeps me in their good graces. You know what I mean? I mean, we kind of go away and we all go away thinking, yeah, we're all together in this. And the fact is that we're not together in it at all. I mean, we're looking at it totally 180 degrees around. And yet there's always that pressure. I feel so much more comfortable if I can find a way of saying something that doesn't make me stand out as being different. I like that feeling, meeting somebody, talking to them, and them going away saying, yeah, that Ron, he's a regular guy. I like people to think of me as a regular guy. Well, there aren't that many people, actually, in the world that think of me as a regular guy, so I always like it when it happens. So the pressure is there. I mean, I don't know about you. Maybe I'm a person that too much cares about what people think of me, but that pressure is there for me. I like that feeling of not being at odds with where everybody is. But what have they gained? The people around me who have invested themselves in things that I think are going to burn, are pursuing values that I think are corrupt, that are against the one who created us. What are they gaining from that? And what do I gain by trying to be a part of it? Paul is calling on us here to confront the reality of what we say we believe. If this is true, then it's true and it makes a difference. So what he's getting at here, I think, is not that if you're not morally perfect that you're going to go to hell, but my faith does call upon me to either embrace the goodness of God, to pursue it, or else to reject it. And in my life, I'm facing that question. What is it in the end? Am I an idolater or not, for instance? He says greed is idolatry. Idolatry is not faith. Idolatry is the opposite of faith. Israel fell in the wilderness in part for being idolaters. God rejected them. They were taken away into Babylon for being idolaters, for being those who did not treat God as if he were God. So it's a big question that we face there. Therefore, do not be partakers with them, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. Don't join the world in its folly. And he uses this image of light. The world is in the dark. And this is, it would be so valuable to us if we could get this through our heads. That the attitude towards sexuality, for instance, that the world around us takes, they take it because they are in the dark. They don't see. Their understanding doesn't go any farther than what their body is telling them. They don't see the purpose for which it was created. They don't see the value of it. They don't understand the Creator who made them and the life that He has called them to. They don't understand anything. That's why it seems so right to do whatever I want with my sexuality. It seems so right to do that because, you know, you remember that old song. Well, there are several old songs. There's the one, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. I think I've forgotten the words of this one, but it's something like, how could something that feels so right be wrong, or something like that. It's that, you know, that idea. What my body is telling me that this is wonderful, so how could it not be wonderful? I mean, how could I say to myself, this thing that seems so wonderful isn't? See, that's the problem with you Christians. You're so hung up. I mean, what is your problem? This is great. I mean, get with it. But there's a blindness there. They are in the dark. We are in the light. By the grace of God, we have had the opportunity to understand something of reality. Yes, sexuality is a great gift, but there are bigger issues in life. And we are coming to understand something of what those are. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. And now finally, this is the reason I'm looking at this whole passage. This was what seemed to me one of the most striking examples of the word goodness in Paul's letters. The fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth. What is the opposite of the darkness that he has been describing? The immorality, impurity, greed, foolishness that he has been describing? We can sum it up with words like goodness, righteousness, and truth. So, I hope it's clear to you, when Paul uses a word like goodness, these are the kinds of issues that he's talking about, as I understand it. It's not this vague sort of, we all ought to be nice to people. Goodness is pursuing that which is fitting and appropriate and right and righteous and holy. It is rejecting the lie that there is no God and that His standards don't mean anything and that fulfillment is to be found in whatever my body tells me is fulfilling. Goodness is to see the truth of who I am as a creature, who God is as my Creator, and what it means to follow Him. It is to reject the lie and to embrace the truth. That's what we're talking about. That's what goodness is. It involves a rejection of evil. And because we are in the light, we are trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. And here's one of those hints that Paul doesn't see us as perfect just because we're Christians. But we are those whose eyes have been opened. We can see there is a God. There is something out there beyond just what my body tells me. And so there is something I need to learn. And we have hearts that are willing to learn what that's about. Okay. Now, I'm running out of time here. Let me see. Let me just finish with 11 and 12. I had more, but I'm not going to have time here. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them, for it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. Again, he doesn't mean it's disgraceful to speak of what evil does. Let's draw a curtain and never talk about what it is that they do there. I think the contrast he's making is, don't think that just because you're not participating with them in actually doing a certain thing, that you're not participating if you join the world in talking as if those things were valuable or funny or hip or whatever. It is disgraceful to talk about such things. Not to point out that they're evil, but to talk about them, to make them a part of your vocabulary the way the world around you does. I think that's the issue that he's talking about. Instead of going along with it and talking about it as if it were just, you know, the way things are, we are to expose it. We are to, and the word is, it's to to show it for what it is, to make it manifest. Let's shine the light on it and see what we're dealing with here. Okay, now, there was more in this passage that I was going to talk about, but I'm not going to, because I want to make a couple of comments here at the end. First of all, the world around us sees real goodness as laughable, and it's something that we need to understand. I don't know, if you listen to popular radio, you know, oldies radio, any of that kind of stuff, you have probably heard a very funny song, I think, by Billy Joel. In this song, the character, the guy in it, is trying to seduce a Catholic girl who obviously has been taught that she ought to hold off on sexuality until she gets married. And there's a whole lot that he has to say to her. At one spot he says, "They say there's a heaven for those who will wait. Some say it's better, but I say it ain't. I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. The sinners are much more fun. Only the good die young." Well, it's a very clever song. I actually admired this song quite a bit for the cleverness of it, not for the sentiment in it, but it's actually very well done. But the fact is, that idea, it's the good who die young. I mean, that clever twist on the old, you know, from the Westerns, you know, it's always the good character is the guy who gets it. And they said, no, it's the good character who misses out on life. You can be good or you can live. That's the message of that song, in essence. We get that message all the time. I mean, I don't know if you're aware how much we get that message from the world around us, that life comes by abandoning goodness. That goodness is somehow is this regrettable sort of necessity that we can really live whenever we can manage to slip its bounds. The fact is, though, that Paul is picturing goodness here as being like light in the darkness. Sin is not real life. Sin is a perversion of life. Immorality is a lie. Sexual immorality is not life and fulfillment. It is a lie. It's killing me now, and it is going to destroy me eternally. I mean, it's a lie about myself. It is a lie about God. It is a lie about my partner. It is a lie about the children that might result from it. It is a lie everywhere along the line. And life doesn't come from lies. Lies kill. Lies destroy. Greed is a lie. You remember that movie Wall Street where the Michael Douglas character says, "Greed is good. Greed works." Well, yeah, I think it does. Greed works. For a while. But it is a lie. And ultimately it's putting me at odds with reality. I'm living in one kind of world, but I think I'm living in another kind of world. Secondly, I wanted to point out that when the world around us does embrace a concept of goodness, it's usually a pretty pale imitation of the biblical concept of goodness. I remember O.J. Simpson trying to argue back at the time of the trial, "I'm a good person." And you know, our culture's concept of goodness is so weak that it's probably true. I mean, good as anybody else. Even someone like Mother Teresa, it seems to me, is kind of a safe picture of goodness for our culture. She's so kind, giving her life to helping the poor and the homeless and so on. Now, don't get me wrong. This is great. I mean, what she did was a wonderful thing. But it's so safe. I mean, it's so removed. I admire her so much for giving her life, for helping those homeless people. And I'm going to be good in the same way, in that I'm going to vote for politicians who say that the homeless ought to be helped. Is the light of the truth breaking through and calling me to a new way of living? I am not an animal. I am a creature of God who makes moral decisions. God has a right to tell me the purpose for which he made me. Fulfillment in living comes from living according to the truth, not in keeping with a lie. I trust God and not wealth, because God is reliable and wealth isn't. Goodness, in the biblical sense, is rooted in a profound shift of understanding about what's going on. Third, not only does the world around us have kind of a pale imitation of goodness, but the church has a pale imitation of goodness as well. We can see it in what Paul's saying to the Galatians. Inasmuch as Paul is speaking to many of the so-called believers of his day who are in fact legalists, who in fact saw themselves as having earned the favor of God by keeping the rules and so on. And one of the ways that you keep yourself convinced that God is on your side is by setting the bar really low for what obedience looks like. If I can minimize the picture of what goodness looks like, then I can convince you that I've kept it, and I can convince myself that I've kept it. And so it makes sense that God would think highly of me. But the fact is, the kind of goodness that we're called to is so lofty and profound and far-reaching that all of us have to recognize that we fall short of it. Even those who are believers in this life fall very much short of it at times. Because we're not trying to minimize it. We're not trying to pretend that it's something that it isn't. And so the world around us, the lie that was in the Billy Joel song, that goodness robs you of life, the world around us is not wrong to reject a goodness of a certain sort. There is the so-called goodness of the legalist, that is in fact mostly self-righteousness, self-satisfaction, that I think the world around us rightly looks at and says, you know, that's not very attractive. If that's what goodness is, then I don't want to be that way. And I think it rightly does. I still think of that song that Bruce Hornsby wrote where he's talking to evangelists on TV, talking back to the TV as he's watching it, and his contemptuous line on why he's not going to send any money or listen to this guy is, I don't want to be like you. And there's something to that. I mean, there are a lot of people out there proclaiming Christianity that in fact, when you look at them and say, I don't want to be like them. And the world is right to do that. Because real goodness is not self-satisfaction. It is not legalism, it is not self-righteousness. It is an acknowledgement that God is God, that I am not what I ought to be, and an attempt to submit my life to the truth. And then finally, we come back then to goodness as the fruit of the Spirit. The passage that came to mind for me is in Ephesians again, earlier in Ephesians, Paul saying that we're not justified by works. It is not my accomplishments that makes me right before God. No, I'm justified through what Christ did on the cross. And what is the result of that? Not that I bring my works to God, but in the turnaround, I am His workmanship. I am not bringing my works to Him, but He is bringing my works to me. If there is goodness in my life, it is a work of God. We are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And we don't want to be thrown by good works. It's not good works in the sense of, you know, feeding the poor and that kind of thing, although that's fine, that's a fine thing to do. But it's a much more expansive idea. We are created for doing things which are in keeping with goodness, everything that might be. The fact that in our lives, you might actually see the beginnings of a distinctiveness from the world, that we are actually coming to value what is good and pursuing those things, is a work of the Spirit of God. Our faith has brought us into the light. So, and we are trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. So, once again, we see, how does this all work itself out? The Spirit of God is at work showing us the truth, convicting us of the reality of the faith, the truth that we have embraced in our faith. And in doing so, then we are becoming committed to the idea that goodness is valuable. We are pursuing it. Goodness is becoming an aspect of our lives. Not that in this age I am perfectly good, but nonetheless there is the fruit of the Spirit in my life that goodness is a quality. I am pursuing it. I am seeking it. I value it. It is what I want my life to be about. And if I don't, then there's something, there's an issue that I still need to face. Okay, well, I'm going to, I got started a little late today, and so I'm going to take a few minutes for questions, even though, technically speaking, we don't have any time for questions.
Your epitaph. Oh, he was a regular guy.
There's my epitaph. He was a regular guy. No, I don't think he was, actually.
I thought I heard you saying something radically different. Let me see if I got this right.
Radically different than what?
Than what I typically think.
Uh-oh.
Greed? No, I mean, that's good. Greed, I think, normally I think of as being obsessed with having too much of some X in this
mm-hmm.
world.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you were saying that greed is being inordinately obsessed with it at all. Inappropriately attached to it at all. That is to say, not with just too much of it, but an inappropriately attached
right.
to
well,
it.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm not sure if I'm catching the distinction. Let me see if I'm catching the distinction that you're talking about. I am. If we in our culture, I think, probably have an idea about greed that would say there comes a point at which I don't need any more. I have everything that I might possibly want. And if I continue to be obsessed with gaining more and more, then my values are screwy and I'm a greedy person. There must be something driving me other than just the natural desire to have comfort and security and even luxury. But, you know, there's something perverse happening. It is certainly not that Paul is warning against.
That would be bad, but...
Pardon me?
I mean, it's not that he's for that, but that's
right,
what he's
right. talking about. Right, what he's warning against is something broader than that. And it's the idolatry thing that shows us what he's getting at. The covetousness that he's describing is that sense that really anything in this world ultimately is going to satisfy me, that it is going to provide my needs. Now, there's a sense in which, I mean, it is not wrong to recognize I need food, I need shelter. I am invited, in fact, to look to God for such things and to see Him as the source of such things. It's not that we're somehow, this is probably a wrong use of this word, but it's not that we're called to be stoics and just think, you know, the only worthwhile existence is one, you know, shivering in a hut somewhere. That's not it. I mean, to value for what it does bring in this life, the needs, the everyday needs of human existence, there's nothing wrong with that. It would be perverse to think, I don't care whether I have a roof over my head. There's no value in that. But it is that sense that is what I must have in order to be safe, in order to be secure, in order to find blessing, in order to find life. That's covetousness. That is that sense that I've got to have it, which is akin to idolatry. Yeah, I think
that's a pretty profound point, because so much of materialism and so much of our lives is driven by a concept of greed that says, as long as I don't past that threshold where I'm wanting too much, mm-hmm. wanting more than I ought to have or more than I need, then I'm okay. And how do we define that? Well, we look to one another to see how much other people need, and that just accelerates. I mean,
it's funny how
they have more than I do, so I must be okay.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is that we're being called upon to ask at every point, not how much do I have, but where is my heart at? What's the nature of my commitment? What's the nature of my hope?
Right. I just might say, as the mic's going back there, I think I've said this sort of thing before, but it is possible for us to get the mistaken idea that somebody who chooses to live simply in the woods in a house that they have built for themselves is somehow by nature doing something good because they're not greedy, they have not gone seeking too much. But it seems to me in that situation that somebody might very well be there in the woods in the house that they made because they have this sense that this is the way I must live. This is where my fulfillment is to be found. And if you were to take it away from me, then I would be lost and I would not have what is necessary. And that's where, no, if I think that a little bit in worldly terms is necessary to find the fulfillment of my life, then I have misunderstood, and I'm a covetous person in that sense. I value it above what it ought to bear. Go ahead, sorry.
This is really great because I can turn it up or turn it down.
Yes. You can turn me up and down too, so.
In your last point, in verse 8, where it says, "For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light." And then in my NASB, mm-hmm. it has a little parentheses,
uh-huh.
which to me means, being the Bible scholar that I am, mm-hmm. or not, it says, "For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth."
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like he's explaining 8, mm-hmm. but it's actually verse 9. So would you go as far to say that as a result, it's sort of like a byproduct of being a child of God that you would exemplify these things, which then leads me to think, well, if I'm not, then what's up?
Yes, yes. He's saying, you are light in the Lord, walk as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth. That the light, I mean, we're to picture the darkness and the light. The darkness is that ignorance, that blindness. I can't see what's real. As children of the light, we have been enlightened. The Spirit of God is at work in us so that we have hearts that can actually begin to see the truth. And then that light has implications. The thing that we have come to understand has implications. So yes, we should, if instead of, in my life, seeing some sort of movement towards goodness and righteousness and truth, instead, I am a person who is characterized by lies and evil and unrighteousness, then yes, I think it does call into question, well, what do you mean by the fact that you are a believer? What do you mean by the fact that, in saying you're a Christian, what does that mean to you? Because the very truths that we are embracing cut against the blindness that of the world around us. It's saying that's not the way it is. So, okay, you're saying, I agree, that's not the way it is, but then you live as if that is the way it is, and there doesn't seem to be any evidence that you have any notion that it's any different, so what do you mean that you believe it? So yeah, there is that. Now, not a simple, immediate, I mean, the fact is it is a struggle. It is, the Bible describes our faith being tested. The Bible describes this in the lives of people, and not just in our lives. Look at the people in the Bible. They all wrestle with this. It's not that it's easy to come to terms with, but it has to say something if I refuse to go there. I mean, Paul is trying to confront them in a sense. Look, here's an arena where you've got to decide what's true. I mean, and it's just one of those places where we have to decide, what does this stuff mean to me? Here he's talking about how we talk, how we conduct ourselves in the world. I don't know that there is probably no Christian who has ever lived who hasn't compromised in the way they talk about things when they're out in the world in one way or another. It's not that it's immediate and obvious how we ought to do that. It's so easy to be misled. But when confronted with it, And as we're trying to work out for ourselves, what is my life about? Ultimately, I have to face this question. You know, the way I talk, you'd think there wasn't any truth to the gospel at all. There's got to be a problem with that. There's got to be something wrong with that. Okay, well, go ahead. We'll take one more.
Well, I didn't really have a question, but just a comment to kind of reinforce what you were saying about our culture's picture of goodness. And Andrew and I went last night to watch the Very Little Theater's production of Harvey. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with that story, but basically it's about a man whose best friend is a 6-foot white rabbit. And by the end of it, it basically sounded like the message of it was, you know, it's okay that this man lives in a dream world and denies reality because at least he's a good person.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's kind, he's patient, he's cooperative, yeah. All those, you know, generous, all those things, those traits that we kind of think of as being a good person. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, it was really attractive because it's like, yeah, it would be nice if we could all be like that. But it really struck me how unbiblical that picture was because, you know, like you say, our true ultimate fulfillment isn't going to be found by denying reality. And
Right. That's a very good comment. And that, I mean, that's a fairly old play at this point, but that idea that the denial of reality somehow, there's something attractive about it, that's not hard to find. And, yeah, that's probably one of the themes we could emphasize most in the Bible. I mean, I'm convinced over and over and over again what the Bible has to say is we start with what's true. Let the chips fall where they may, but start with what's true. What's real. If you're living in keeping with what is true, then you're on the right track. And if you're not, then reality is going to crush you. That's the bottom line. Okay, well, thanks for your patience. We ran a little over, but...